702.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on the Prime Media Plus app
and on DSTV channel 856.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Midday Report. It's just gone 7 minutes past 12. My name is T.D. Madia, standing in for Mandy Wiener today and for the rest of the week. Coming up on the show, the Electoral Commission in Gauteng is hosting a signing of the Electoral Code of Conduct. Former Tshwane Mayor Dr. Morunwa Makwarela passes on. I'm not sure what to make of this particular event, because if you remember and if you listen to the bulletin, this is the former mayor who's got a cloud hanging over his head. What do you make of it? You know, we are being asked to remember him in good light. What do you remember of the former Tshwane Mayor? He had a very short stint as the number one citizen of the capital. We'll also go to Emfuleni, where water issues persist. We'll look at political newcomer Rise Mzansi that's out and about in the Western Cape. And of course, we'll look at the Nafis Modak matter. Police Minister Becky Cele is handing over a new police station in Donnybrook. That and lots more coming up in the show. You're more than welcome to engage with us and share your thoughts on some of these stories.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
We start in Gauteng, where the Electoral Commission in the province is hosting a signing of the Electoral Code of Conduct. 52 political parties and 5 independent candidates are contesting the elections. Through the signing of this pledge, they are publicly declaring that they'll adhere with the Code of Conduct. Joining us for the story is EWN's Thabiso Gorba, who's on the line. Thabiso, good afternoon. Thank you for your time. Let's speak about what an Electoral Code of Conduct actually looks like at first. What kind of guidelines are these political parties committing themselves to adhering to?
Good afternoon, CD. Well, the Electoral Code of Conduct is usually signed before the start of the elections. I don't think it's anything that is too shocking for people. It's obviously that political parties and independents now commit to ensuring that they will promote free and fair elections. They commit to ensuring that they will not use language that invokes violence. They commit to ensuring that they will work with the IEC possible. They commit to ensuring that, you know, they won't carry weapons at political rallies, and they commit to ensuring that they won't work, they won't bribe voters or do anything untoward to influence or intimidate voters at voting stations, but also to ensure that they abide by the Electoral Act. Now, we do know, CD, that some of the fines, or the most serious fines from the electoral of not abiding by the Electoral Code of Conduct, is that an independent or a party can have their registration cancelled. So, it's a very, very serious document. Mm.
Let's speak about the IEC itself. It surely would have a message for these political parties. One imagines a message in line with the guidelines that you've just set out. What did they have to say?
Yes, it is 100% TD. But I think before we get to that, there is obviously some very interesting that were communicated today by the IEC Provincial Head Office. So obviously that we do know that 6.5 million people in Gauteng are registered to vote. That is the largest big block of voting, largest voting block in the country by far. It represents about 24%. But in terms of voting station city, there's about 2,797 voting stations in Gauteng. And interesting, CD, about 248 of those voting stations won't have electricity, about 248 won't have water, and about 416 won't have wheelchair access. So this is obviously one of those issues that the IEC has highlighted. But the IEC chairperson, Mosotu Moepia, talked about, CD, that, you know, this electoral code of conduct, he wishes that it wasn't just for these elections, but for the entire election period, which is obviously starts around 2 or 3 years before the elections. And this is what he had to say about the importance of signing the electoral pledge.
This is our democracy. I want to thank you as you pledge, but I also want to remind you that you are one nation. You are one people. You are united in this effort. that our leaders in Gauteng are going to come among you. Let us conduct ourselves as the worthy leaders that all of society will look forward to. We sing, even as we start the sessions, and pray that God would bless our nation. May it be so, even as we approach these elections. They are a watershed moment. Let us not soil the history, the rich history we have as a nation. May you remain blessed even as you go forward. Thank you indeed.
The voice that you're hearing there is of the IEC's chairperson, and Tate Mosotho Moyepa. Speaking there earlier, I was speaking to Thabiso Gqwaba, who's there for EWN. But listening in on that particular conversation at the moment is Sanet Solomon from the University of South Africa, a political expert, speaking to us about, who's going to join us now on the line to speak to us about a province like Gauteng. So for me, KZN, Gauteng, much like KZN, I think to a degree, the Western Cape, are the battlegrounds of these particular elections, with each one of them being up for grabs. Remember here, the ANC is holding on to power literally by a shoestring. I'm referring to Gauteng. And I think they would have to mount a massive fight in order to remain in power. Sanet, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
The battle for the soul of Gauteng is really what I think is at play. I was watching a lot of visuals over the weekend where there were so many political parties on the ground in KZN. I'm expecting to see that picture shift to Gauteng. Am I incorrect in that expectation?
I don't think that you are incorrect in that. I do think, as you and your previous guest mentioned, Gauteng is the biggest voting district, with it having 23.6% of the registered voters. And I think while KZN is a contested block in terms of the MK party coming in there and all of the other political parties trying to find their footing, I do think that a number of political parties also want to establish themselves in Gauteng. And I think as a result, we see a lot of door-to-door campaigning. We have been seeing a lot of political parties visiting churches and other organizations trying to garner support and so on. So I think that we'll be seeing that intensify, especially in the run-up to the elections, which is just 5 weeks away.
In your sense, all of this, the attempts to try and have voter contact, what does it give Gauteng when the dust settles? So what are your thoughts about where Gauteng will be once they've voted, the outcome? Does it look to you like it's a certainty that the province will go to coalitions, for instance?
I think the likelihood of coalitions in Gauteng is quite large. I don't think that there is a political party at the moment that would have the ability to win an outright majority. I think here we would be seeing a very interesting coalition. I think you would be seeing the EFF, you'd be seeing the DA, Action SA, the Patriotic Alliance, and the ANC trying to formulate their own version of a coalition. And I think here it would be quite interesting to see who would be pairing. But I also think it's quite concerning, because we've known that coalitions haven't been very stable in terms of this particular province.
Sanet, I want to do a quick comparison between Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. Some might say it's rooted in history when you think about some of the violence that we've seen in some of our provinces. But the issue of violence doesn't underpin contestation in Gauteng as it does in a KZN. We worry. You hear about political killings in KZN. You don't necessarily hear about them in Gauteng. Is it a matter of it being underreported? Is that not the characteristic? And even if it isn't, why is it that it's so different in how the politics or the contestation plays itself out in this province versus a KZN?
Love your question. I think that context matters in this instance. For example, KZN unfortunately has a very violent history in terms of the ANC and the IFP, for example. And we know this dates back for quite a number of years. But I also think with the passing of the IFP leader and the introduction of the MK party, I think that also throws a spanner in the works. I do think that the province, for example, has a different makeup. I do think that traditional leadership and traditional customs and so on play a more important role in terms of KZN, where it's quite different in terms of Gauteng, where it tends to be more metropolitan. And so I think here you have to get your traditional authorities to be more involved in order to quell that violence, but you also have to get the political parties to actually adhere to the Electoral Commission's conduct. which they have signed and so on. But I think something that I would say, which is quite interesting, is that a lot of the violent hotspots for the elections are rightfully in KZN. I believe there's five which are being closely monitored. And I do think that we'll be seeing more police presence in terms of KZN, whereas that won't necessarily be the case in Gauteng. I just think that the environment is very different. Mm. I think the historical context is very different. And I know we always just say, no, like we should move with the times and so on. But I do think that a lot needs to be done in terms of just quelling down this, like, I don't know if you want to call it anger and so on in terms of the province. But I also think that KZN is very underdeveloped. If you go off the highway, for example, lots of those rural towns have high levels of poverty, high levels of unemployment and so on. There's underdevelopment and so on. And while the statistics are telling us that there is an increase in the number of people who have been employed, for those of us who recently visit the province, we know that it's not necessarily the case when you are on the ground.
Thank you for that. Just before I let you go, I want to pick very quickly your brain around this MK and ANC matter. The ANC determined to fight for its legacy. It's appealing the High Court, Durban High Court judgment around the trademark issue with the MK party. I wanted to make an argument that, look, the MK party has won 3-for-3, if you may. That particular matter, as well as the other ANC matter and the objection matter that was brought forward by the IEC, should the ANC not be parking this matter and focusing on the elections? Am I wrong to say perhaps that their focus is in the wrong place?
I don't think that you're wrong. I think in this instance, 5 weeks is not a lot of time. I do think that while they are busy engaging in legal battles with the MK party, I'm not sure if you've seen the kind of mobilization that the MK has been doing on the ground and so on. I think that while you have a number of people focused on this, I think that the ANC should be intensifying its door-to-door campaigning. It should be intensifying, garnering its support, trying to reestablish support in areas where it's lost support and so on. I do think that they've been quite distracted for quite a bit of time, and we can understand why. But I think, as it's rightfully been mentioned, there's not going to be any confusion in terms of the ANC and the MK on the ballot box. I think that you can fight for your historical significance and your legacy at a later stage. But I think now it's time to try and garner the support of the electorate. And I think it's quite sad when you open up a Google search and you try to read up the news for the day that the ANC is so closely affiliated with the MK, because that's in another way also giving a lot of media attention to the political party, which is not something that I think they directly want to do.
All right, thank you so much for your time. That's Eunisa's Sanette Solomon giving us her thoughts on Gauteng, as well as this battle between the MK party and the ANC. My take really is, she said there's 5 weeks before the elections. I think the ANC is not focused. Somebody said to me during former President Jacob Zuma's stint, right, as head of the ANC, there was a COPE, there was an EFF, and you know what? The ANC did not speak about those parties. It focused on itself. We criticize the opposition for talking too much about the ANC and not focusing on what it's meant to do. And ANC, at this point in time, should be looking at its own goals and trying to make good with the electorate. And I think it's all over the place, and it recognizes that it's actually campaigning on behalf of the MK party. What are your thoughts? Am I wrong? Am I seeing it wrong? Is Sanette seeing it wrong? 0727021702 0725671567. What are your thoughts about the way the political landscape is playing itself out? And of course, what must happen in Gauteng when the dust settles on May the 29th?
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Former Tshwane Mayor Dr. Morunwa Makwarela has passed on following a short illness. I think he was 52 at the time of his passing. Makwarela is a former speaker in the Tshwane Council, but most of you will remember him from that very short stint as mayor, sometime between February 2023 and March that same year. He dies, of course, with a cloud hanging over his head with allegations of fraud after allegedly submitting a fake insolvency rehabilitation certificate. Makwarela was declared insolvent in August 2016. And although the law prohibits insolvent people from holding public office, he was elected as a councillor after the 2021 municipal elections. Do you remember that back and forth with COPE over whose responsibility is it to vet these candidates who become councillors? That back and forth, but at the heart of it was this particular issue that the then mayor was facing. Speaker of Council Ncweti Nzwanana has paid tribute to the late former mayor and has asked us to remember him for the good work that he's done. Take a listen.
Good morning to everybody, the residents of Tshwane, the councillors at large. It is a sad day for us because we have lost the important person, the former speaker, the former mayor and the councillor of Tshwane, which is Dr. Makwarela. He has lost his life this morning. We really, really, it is a sad day for the city. It is a sad day for the office of the speaker as well, because he is my predecessor. I took over from him and I continue from where he left. And I'd like to say to the family and the community, the residents of Tshwane, condolences. Akuhlanga kuyahlanga, uThixo ebenikile and uThixo uthathile.
That's the Speaker of Council Ncweti Nzwanana, who's paid tribute to the late former Tshwane Mayor, Dr. Morona Makwarela, and of course, sending out condolences to his loved ones.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
That's right, you're listening to the Midday Report with myself, TD Madia, standing in for Mandy Wiener. It's just 26 minutes past 12. I want to bring on now Monge Zikoko from EWN. So a few weeks ago, residents in Emfuleni were being urged to boil their water. It was said to have been contaminated, of course, this after spilled sewage pipe rendered water supplied to Palm Springs, Zone 7, Sibukeng, Beverly Hills, yes, Rinaleona here in the locals, Sonderwater and Everton were deemed too dangerous for human consumption. Now, EWN is back in those areas. We speak now to Monge Zikoko. Monge, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Now, the water is supposedly now safe for human consumption. Is that correct?
That's right, OCD. Well, what happened, Ms. Sebo, what happened over the past couple of days is that the local municipality, the Emfuleni municipality, released a statement. This follows two other statements. Like you said, the boiling notice, and prior to that, the issuing out of cutting the water completely due to the contamination. Now, recently, they released another statement where they said that the water is good to go after undergoing rigorous testing. This is not the reality, though, of the people who live in these affected areas. They say to this day, they can see with the naked eye some of the leftovers they believe that comes from the contaminated, well, the sewage pipe that spilled and ultimately contaminated the water. They have bemoaned, of course, the government for not really taking the necessary steps in ensuring that the water is clean. And this also comes on the backdrop of a number of incidents that have led these residents to lose faith in the municipality. I want you to take a listen to these residents that I spoke to who have expressed their displeasure and dissatisfaction with how the municipality is handling this.
For the children, I boil the water. Even before cooking, I ensure that I boil the water.
All right, that is also a business owner who takes care of a number of toddlers. I think she has around about 30 children under her care. And what she says is that this particular incident has placed her in such a predicament where she's afraid that parents or eventually the Department of Health will come to her and ultimately accuse her of putting the children's lives in danger. She says the only precautionary steps that she can take at this moment is to boil the water that she collects herself through a number of tanks in the backyard of the house that she uses as a daycare.
Mungis, just very quickly though, with residents feeling this uncomfortable and worried about the quality of the water, is the municipality doing anything to try and allay their fears? Are the officials within that these affected communities saying, look, we have tested this water safe to drink, and maybe even showing some illustrations of themselves drinking the water to show residents that they can trust the water?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to see them trying and drinking the water, but I did get a chance to speak to to a spokesperson of the Empuleni local municipality, and he walked me through the extensive report that came from scientists and engineers, like he said, who ensured that the water is safe for consumption. He believes that the water is now back to the standard that it was prior to the sewage spillage. He has not, unfortunately, gone out to the community to witness some of these things. I've brought forward the concerns of the community members, but EWN is yet to receive a response from the Empuleni local municipality.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. That's Mongezi Koko from EWN out in Empuleni. Surely the proof is in the pudding. It's in the pudding. It's one thing to say, here's what the report is stating about the water. But if you want people to believe you, you must maybe be seen within the community drinking the very water you expect them to use. No? Am I wrong? Is it me? I don't know. I think it would have been easier to win their trust. I don't know. That's Mongezi, who's out in Empuleni.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Hi, regarding the death of the mayor, now, I don't know why suddenly, when people die, we are asked to forget all the ills that they do. The one that comes to mind is Mantu Shabalala Msimang. You know, as a healthcare professional, that woman was single-handedly responsible for the deaths of thousands of people thanks to her AIDS denialism. And when she died, suddenly all of that is expected to be forgotten, and she's expected to be remembered as a saint who did no wrong. Same with the mayor now. You know, whatever wrongs he did, now you suddenly expected to forget it. Doesn't work like that.
Thank you so much for that voice note. I remember the era of African potatoes, wasn't it, and beetroot. Yeah, quite difficult. But I think, is it Voltaire who says, to the dead we owe the truth? And I can't disagree with that. I was here. I spoke about Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi and how I understood his history. And today I stand here and I say, I understand the mayor, former mayor has passed on, but I also understand that he had a cloud over his head. He had 4 allegations to answer to at the time of his passing. Thank you for your voice notes. Keep them coming. 072-702-1702-072-567-1567.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 12:36. You are still listening to the Midday Report. My name is TD Madia, standing in for Mandy Wiener, keeping an eye on a couple of stories. We earlier had Thabiso Okoba, who was out and about with the IEC, where political parties are signing the code of conduct. 52 political parties and 5 independents making a play for your vote. We are, 5 weeks away now from casting votes. Just really, what do you think of it? I watch on the weekends. I go out where I can as a journalist, because that's my other job, and I try and see what they're doing on the ground with their voter contact, because that's what most political parties are doing. Are you convinced by the messages? Are you worried about what will happen to this province when the dust settles? Are people in the Western Cape worried about what happens there? Rise Mzansi is out and about. We'll also touch base with what they're doing.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Turning our attention now to what I think is, there's no question that this is a crisis. So in at least 89 gender-based violence cases were struck off the roll in various courts in the Western Cape between April and September 2023. We are joined now by the Western Cape Police Oversight and Community Safety MEC, Regan Allen, to try and understand what is going on. Thank you so much for your time. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having this difficult conversation, and we are delighted to provide an overview on the work that we do in this space. Thank you.
Mr. Allen, let's just start with just the stats themselves, finding out that these cases are struck off the roll and the link to police inefficiencies in these cases not being heard and finding closure in the courts.
It is deeply horrific. It leaves one frustrated, considering that when a particular matter is not seen to by our courts, it actually leads to secondary victimization, but it also leads to a further lack of trust in the entire criminal justice system, which could in future even allow for someone not to want to make a case in the very first place. You have read out the quarter between April and December, which was 89 gender-based violence cases which were struck off the court roll. If I add in the October to December amount, it actually is the additional 85, which brings us between and December up to 174 such cases which were struck off the court roll. And it's deeply problematic because we always aim in our province to ensure that our oversight can actually lead to better service delivery so that residents and victims ultimately get the closure that they need.
So Police Minister Becky Cele often says they arrest criminals. What goes wrong is what happens in the courts. So there's a weird back and forth between what the police do versus what the courts ought to do. In your case, you're responsible for policing in your province. We speak about these inefficiencies around the police. What do you think is going wrong in that relationship between the two? Is it a question of we must finger point, or do we look to you and say you must take responsibility about what police have failed to do and why they're responsible and being pointed at in what goes wrong with these cases?
Thank you so much. I would never want to receive a free pass. Currently, our constitution in terms of section 206 allows for a provincial government to have policing oversight. We don't have the direct mandate and management of the South African Police Service. We have oversight. I always maintain that our oversight must lead to better service delivery. And I am advocating continuously to ensure that we can actually have the full responsibility of having the policing powers and the mandate to ensure that we actually can create a policing service that is professional, that when you call, a van will actually be dispatched, that when a case is registered, it will actually be investigated. But that is not to give us a free pass in terms of our oversight. So on the one hand, definitely when we look at the cases that we monitor, it is actually twofold. Because before a particular case is listed onto our court system, an investigation should have been conducted, and that investigative powers sits with the South African Police Service. We have already also highlighted in our report to the South African Police Service in that of those cases, if I look at the matters for the third quarter, there were 17 sanctions, which was against SAPS members for incomplete investigations. And those sanctions range from a warning, a reprimand, or even a dismissal, considering that a SAPS officer must fulfill his or her duty. It is worrying, though, that in those 17 cases, 12 of those matters were withdrawn by the complainants. I've then taken that further to ensure that we can actually have further advocacy work to be done in terms of the transversal forum to increase the advocacy so that victims do not withdraw from these cases that is already in court as well, and where there's a sanction even against a SAPS member. So I would most definitely one day want to have that full responsibility. I think it makes total sense for a provincial government to have policing powers, because then our provincial needs and priorities will be taken into account. But currently SAPS and the mandate sits fully at a national competency. However, that is not to give us a free pass. Hence, we are always wanting to step in and step up.
I want to let you go, but before I do, very quickly, are you worried about the sanctions? Are you satisfied with the sanctions? Do you see them sticking? Because often, again, we hear of police getting into trouble. They're given sanctions. They don't stand. One day you hear police officers been suspended because they've done something wrong. 2 months later, the person is back at work as if nothing ever happened. Are you satisfied with the way those are being dealt with?
We would definitely never be fully satisfied. However, we definitely see that we are heading in the right way. And if we look at various components within the South African Police Service, the disciplinary process, to a large extent, have left us deeply worried, considering that when SAPS does not do their work, we need to ensure that the sanctions actually stick, that those members are either dismissed, they receive a final warning, or whatever the sanction may direct, because it sends a wrong message, not only to communities, that when SAPS members are not reprimanded or that the sanctions are not sticking, but it also sends a message to our credible officers. And when I speak to officers on the ground, they will always tell me how difficult it is when they know that some within the service are not doing their job. It paints the entire service in a bleak way and in a negative way. Hence, the call for devolution of policing powers to a provincial government actually, like I've said, makes sense. So we can actually fix the entire disciplinary process within the South African Police Service, but also make sure that we can address other matters like skewed allocations, etc.
All right, thank you so much. That's the Western Cape Police Oversight and Community Safety MEC, Regan Allen. Listening in on that conversation, who I want to bring on now is Margriet Holthausen. I hope I say that correctly. She's the Executive Director of the Trauma Center. Margriet, have I said your name correctly?
It's Margriet, but it's I'm Margriet, Marita, I'm Maggie.
I'm fine. Thank you so much for your time, Margriet. A serious matter really on our hands, hearing that 89 GBV cases were struck off the roll in various courts in the Western Cape between April and September 2023. Let me first start with your reaction to this revelation.
You know that... We work on the ground as trauma center counselors. We work close with the police, often in the communities, not often, 4 days a week in the communities, often at police stations. Most of our outreach officers is at police stations. So we get cases of people who come and report domestic violence, especially domestic violence and gender-based violence, and then they come to our office, and it happens. Unfortunately, it still happens that clients come to us and say that somebody didn't even want to take their case. In the charge office, they didn't want to take the case. They didn't want to open a case for domestic violence because it's a domestic issue. We unfortunately still get it. Recently, one of my counselors had a client to whom a detective said, "I don't know why you may open a case here about domestic violence. I also beat my wife." So we sit with gendered attitudes that is not only out there in the community, it's also in our police force. And I'm not saying they aren't passionate people, but that is one of the problems.
Margriet, you speak about those being one of the problems. We've often, for many years, there's lots of talk about what the police need to do when they're faced with cases like that. When a case like that arrives at a police station, these are the steps that you ought to take. This is the attitude you got to have. That conversation happens almost every year, even during the days where we're highlighting action against gender-based violence. Why is it, though, that we seem to still be getting it wrong? Why is it, though, that the conversation around police inefficiencies and the issues that you're pointing out are still a problem?
You know, I mean, probably it has to do with management. Maybe they have all the beautiful policies, but when it comes to implementation, I mean, let me just give you this example. The new Domestic Violence Act, the old one and the new one, the amended one, has a Form 1. I want to ask the listeners to Google Form 1 Domestic Violence Act. It literally states verbatim what the police officer has to say to victims of domestic violence. So there's no excuse, really. There's no excuse. So just copy that and read that to every victim that comes in. And in terms of rape and gender-based violence, especially sexual violence, it's often, you know, that the perpetrators are still out there in the community. So our victims, they do come and report. We also had cases where somebody reports and then sharing confidential information with a charge officer, and then somebody else says, "Oh, we know about your case." And then that victim says, "Let me withdraw because the perpetrator is connected to us. Organized crime, clearly infiltrated in the police. Let me withdraw my case because here I'm not going to win. This is too big for me." That often happens.
I'm sorry to cut in there. I want to be able to let you go. But before I do, I just want to get your very, very quickly, very briefly, what are the solutions? What do we do? Especially that because the former guest, Regan Allen, also spoke about advocacy. What do we do? Just in short.
We need sustainable services on the ground. We need prevention services. We need to work on the attitudes towards gender and power over the whole spectrum of South Africa, from politicians to state officials. We have to look at what support is there for victims. It's very difficult to go through a court process if you're still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which is linked to avoidance. You don't actually want to think about what happened.
Somebody
has to help you and support you through that process. There's so much needed. Let's support counseling services on the ground.
All right, thank you.
Let's put a budget to prevention of gender-based violence.
I think that's an important
thing. Because that's where we have to start.
Thank you so much. That's a very important point. No. Thank you for your time. I'm going to leave it there with you. That's Margriet Holthausen, the Executive Director of the Trauma Center, saying, let's put budgets, let's put efforts into supporting victims to make sure that they also are able to deal with the trauma that comes with these incidents.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Staying in the Western Cape, Rise Mzansi, one of the many newcomers on the political scene, is on the ground in the Western Cape today. It's presenting its plan to bring about a safe, prosperous, equal and united province. I keep saying Western Cape, like Gauteng and KZN, is really up for grabs. Its national leader, Songezo ZB, is with the Western Cape Premier candidate, Akolile Notswala, in Khayelitsha. This is also where we find EWN's Babalo Ndenze, who joins me now on the line. Babalo, good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I was just saying, it's quite clear that Western Cape is up for grabs. Rise Mzansi seems to believe that it's able to do something to change the fate of many in the Western Cape. What is the crux of their message today?
Yes, indeed, CD. Rise Mzansi continuing the party's push in the province. They're back today. Leader Songezo ZB has been in Cape Town quite a few times, and he clearly seems that the Western Cape will become a hotly contested province come the polls, and you know, all suggestions point that way. And the Rise Mzansi leadership, Songezo ZB, as well as the premier candidate, you know, Akolile Notswala, basically giving or presenting the party's plans for the province, you know, which include things around safety and security, social housing, as well as, you know, placing a moratorium, for example, on the sale of state land. But they also addressed other issues related to politics in the province, mainly directed at the DA and its leader, John Steenhuisen. As we know, John Steenhuisen has made quite a point about Rise Mzansi's presence in the province in this election campaign. But let's just take quickly a listen to what Akolile Notswala had to say about the matter.
I want to address the issue of the DA and John Steenhuisen calling us political mercenaries and suggesting that I am corrupt, and suggesting that we are corrupt, that these leaders here are corrupt. I take serious offense to that. Many will say this is politics and it is political. Yes, I agree. This is political offense. Because what John Steenhuisen said is also a dog whistle politics. It is vile. It is unsophisticated.
It is unsophisticated, saying that he does take it personally. Babalo, they have a plan around uniting the province. I think in some of the criticism that the DA gets as far as the Western Cape is concerned is that it hasn't done enough to address issues like spatial planning, apartheid spatial planning, that it's not been able to cater to the majority. It caters to the elite. I'm sure part of what they put on offer must be around those issues. I mean, you spoke about social housing earlier. They must speak about those issues in order to try and unite the Western Cape.
Yes, indeed. You know, the leaders say that the divide has been sustained by the DA for the past 15 years in the province. And some of the plans to bridge the gap or bridge the divide between these affluent and, you know, underprivileged communities are around security and safety. You know, increasing, for example, crime intelligence to deal with the crime situation in these poorer communities, as well as, you know, focusing on the issue of drugs in these provinces, but also ending apartheid spatial planning, you know, when it comes to social housing and placing a moratorium on the sale of public land. And there's an argument that a lot of the land in the Western Cape gets sold off, you know, to private entities, and it should rather be used for social housing and these Rise Umzansi has identified, you know, some military bases in the Western Cape where they want to provide thousands of housing opportunities in those military bases that are state-owned by the province.
All right.
And they also want to, you know, repurpose the buildings, the department buildings, basically in the city, and relocate those departments, you know, to areas that are less dense, and then instead convert those buildings into social housing opportunities. So a lot of focus on that, including housing and safety and security.
All right, thank you so much. That's EWN's Baba Londenze, who's out and about in the Western Cape with Rise Umzansi.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Hi, TD. Condolences to the Makorela family. I remember Dr. Makorela as a highly educated genetic engineer with a genuine PhD, for that matter, someone who this country could have made good use of. And one just wonders, this sequestration thing, I think we need to understand what the consequences of being sequestrated really are out of public office. Thanks, Farai.
Thank you so much for that voice note, Farai. You've got a fair point there, but for me, with all the talent and, yes, genuine PhD, I think you go wrong when you make decisions where you submit, presumably, a fake document when you actually know what the truth is and the consequences thereof. And it's quite unfortunate because he's not here. He's not going to be here to answer to that. But I get your point. I absolutely get your point that the consequences of these issues, these moments, the sequestration, what does it mean, is something well worth delving into a little bit further.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa has been in the news quite a bit lately. It's made significant strides in rebuilding the passenger rail infrastructure. 31 of the 41 lines are now operational. That's what PRASA says. This morning, I saw Transport Minister Sindisiwe Chikunga on one of the trains in Cape Town. EWN's Ntuthuzelo Nene joined in for the ride. We speak to him now. Ntuthuzelo, good afternoon. Welcome to the show. Let's start with the reasons why the minister was on the trains in the Western Cape specifically today.
The minister was in town, as you've mentioned, to assess those strides that have been made to improve the rail network and restore some of the idle lines that were impacted by vandalism and theft in the Western Cape. Now, we know a pressing concern for most rail commuters in this province is the timeline of a full central line operation. Now, the minister is saying that train services between Khayelitsha and the CBD, which carries the most bulk of the people into the city, is the next priority, and that services between the CBD and Nolungile train station in Khayelitsha will resume next month. She was also here today to launch train number 200 of the new blue trains that we've seen operating countrywide, saying that the target for these blue trains, they plan to have about 600 of them running by 2031. And actually saying that, you know, these milestones that they've reached since COVID, or the strides that they've made since COVID, are something besides, you know, politicking, something to, you know, to celebrate as a country. Let's hear what she had to say.
The trains that we are seeing here today are trains that are manufactured here in South Africa. It is trains that are manufactured by our South African engineers and artisans. It is the state-of-the-art trains that we don't import. We use our equipment and material to manufacture these blue trains that you are seeing out there. It is all happening here in South Africa. It is a good story for our democracy, a story that we must tell.
That's Transport Minister Sindisiwe Chikunga out in Cape Town speaking about the good story that they must tell around the trains. I have a question around how we got here and the involvement of our government and government failings in how we got here. It's all good and well to talk about the good story, but you must do so as you take accountability and responsibility. I'm also a little bit worried about sabotage, because that's what was blamed previously, right? About things going wrong. When things start working, we must celebrate, but we must celebrate in the hope that they work beyond May the 29th, if you get what I mean. It's now 1 o'clock. Thank you so much for tuning in. That's it from me.